Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Everyone, hope you've continued to enjoy and learn from our episodes on Russia's invasion of Ukraine through a couple different lenses. As we said, as we're working through these episodes and topics this month, we are continuing to work on iterating the show in a couple different directions. One of those directions is much more back and forth traditional podcast as opposed to just the traditional interviews we've done. So when I talked about this new format for the show, people asked me to bring back Dmitry Kofinis, who is the host of the Hidden Forces podcast. Sagar and I previously appeared on Hidden Forces. I suggest you go check out that episode if you're interested in that. But Dmitry is just a really great guy. He's really interesting. He used to work at RT, a station which is frankly now banned from the United States, so that's an interesting conversation that we get into today, but lots of good stuff. We'll keep it nice and tight. We've got more interview episodes coming up the rest of this week. So quick notes: one, check out the Substack. Two, there isn't a book on this episode, but there's a bunch of books that are really relevant, so go check out those as well too. Three, as per usual, we really appreciate tips when you all enjoy episodes. Four, and this is a really important one, we are getting record-breaking traffic on these episodes. I think it's because we can provide a space where people can take the daily news, which we're not covering as much, and provide bigger ideas and frameworks for people to think about. So it would be amazing if you all would share any episode that you really enjoy with your friends. And of course, I will bring back our request for folks to give us 5-star ratings on Apple Podcasts and ratings on Spotify as well too, with a review written added as well too, if you can. Finally, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work, and a shout out to the Substack, which you could also subscribe to as well. Hope you enjoy the episode. Dmitry Kofinis, welcome back to The Realignment.
It's great to be back, Marshall. Thank you for having me.
I said this before the episode, we've started adding more just discussion back and forth, more traditional podcast episodes. When I pointed this out, folks immediately asked for you to come back on, because I think because we've done this a few times, we have good chemistry and we can just kind of go back and forth. So you're not a guest. I'm not interviewing you. I'm basically moderating the conversation, but we're just really talking about a bunch of things. So this will mark the fourth episode in our near daily coverage of the Ukraine crisis with Russia's invasion of the country. We're recording this on Friday at 11 a.m. So keep that in mind. This obviously is not a news program, so I'm not going to make any claims of, well, Dmitry, the convoy is at this specific position as of this morning. So this is going to age well. I'll be sure to keep it that way. But look, we spoke originally right after the invasion had started. Let's just set the table with your perspective on how things stand right now, as broad or as specific as you want to go.
Had we, I remember us speaking actually before the invasion started. We spoke a week before, depending on what you mean by the invasion. I thought the invasion was officially Wednesday, Friday of last week.
Wow.
And I spoke before mind, that. Yeah.
My yeah. mind has no, rotted. I know. And this is unfiltered.
The same thing has happened to all of us.
I'm going to keep this in the, normally we'd edit this part out, but okay, I have no idea what the actual date is. So please.
Yeah, it was actually the Thursday before the invasion. So a week before the invasion. But again, you know, this has been a really weird, twilighty type of period. You know, the Biden administration has been ringing the alarm bell for several months. A lot of people weren't listening. A few people were also ringing the alarm bell along with the Biden administration. I think, again, you and I talked about this last time I was on. At the time, I said that I felt that the Biden administration had done a really comparable, if not masterful, job of managing the information war and sort of prepping the battlefield, so to speak, in terms of creating a framework in people's heads to think about this possible invasion. I actually think of it in similar terms to how we think of how companies educate consumers ahead of a product launch. Because of that prepping, I think that's why the alliance, the Western alliance, was so ready to go from the very beginning. They ran interference against the Russians and took away their ability to not just surprise their enemy, but also to claim some kind of moral high ground, which would have led to some level of confusion and maybe a period of time on the part of the Western allies to sort of come together. None of that happened. And it has been a remarkable success from that standpoint for what is otherwise a humanitarian tragedy.
I want to really start there because, unfortunately, because it just came out early this morning, you didn't have time to listen to the David Kilcullen episode. You've had him on your show, though. I suggest people check out Hidden Forces for any shout outs we do during this episode. But something that Dave pointed out was he actually wasn't particularly happy with Biden taking the use of NATO forces in Ukraine off the table. And what I just want to add, and I argue this, is it builds on the point you just made, which is by taking NATO troops off the table from the start, it completely removed any moral high ground Putin could have had. Because we all know, you and I both know, because we've covered this information space, they would have used that as, see, this is a provocation, this is ambiguity. So militarily, because Dave was making a military argument, you know, he's a retired lieutenant colonel, I understand where ambiguity could have served Ukraine better on a pure military basis. But when it comes to the Western alliance, when it comes to the American public, having that completely no gray zone whatsoever was just really key.
Interesting. Well, I'm the last person to argue with David Kilcullen. His credentials are obviously superior to mine in every single way on this matter. I'm actually excited to hear the episode. Congratulations. You've been doing a great job, as I told you. I'm excited to hear and understand better what he was thinking, because one, just there's a difference between what the Biden administration says and what the Russian public hears, which is really what would matter in this case, I think. And I guess also the West, I suppose, although I don't know. I don't immediately see the significant cost to the moral standing of the West if Biden came out forcefully and said that NATO will not protect any of Ukrainian territory. In fact, I actually thought that he did say that, to be honest. I remember him being very clear about how there is not going to be any military intervention in Ukraine. So I'm a little confused about that.
Yeah, I just should have set that up better. What we were just debating, though, was taking off any type of military intervention off the table is going to a certain degree, give Putin an ability to move and operate with certainty that militarily could arguably not be.
Oh, you're saying he was not in favor of that. He was in favor of strategic ambiguity.
Yeah,
in this case, I understand.
I'm not going to say he was fully. He was just raising the dynamic. And my response,
understood.
Yeah,
that makes more sense. And that perfectly possible. Sure.
And it's just, it's the frustrating part of this dynamic. But I just think the key thing was this has been set up in a way that has removed that gray zone. And this is what we talked about last episode, where frankly, Russia and Putin really succeed in. So let's talk about the area.
I would want to say one more thing before you say that, to bolster David's point. I think that in my view, what I've learned from following Russian foreign policy and Russian aggression over the years is that it's sort of a cliche, but it does seem that the only thing that he really understands is force. And so to that, I think, supports David's point. But go ahead. I just wanted to say that.
Yeah, no, and I agree. And the part that's just so tough here is, and this is interesting for you and I, because we both do American domestic politics, and not that you're a political podcaster, but what you talk about hits on domestic politics. So I'm just consistently aware of, as a hawkish person, this is my, identity thing that I have to be very clear about. I have to recognize that my position is probably, based on polling, out of step with the mainstream consensus. So I am just hyper aware of the fact that what consistently has caused so much trouble for hawkish persons in the past is overstretching whatever the domestic political consensus was, or telling yourself everyone is really here. So I think that's just the useful caution I've picked up just from studying this period.
I also want to mention that I think one of the things that's damaged that sort of hawkishness, as you say, is its conflation with a broader ideological agenda of nation building. Mm-hmm. So it's one thing to use hawkishness as a deterrent. It's another thing to use hawkishness as a way to construct the global order that you want, which is what it was associated with in the early neocon days of the Bush administration.
No, I love that you just said that, because that actually gets to the realignment point. And I think this is why a lot of folks in the information space, especially in independent media, who had their views very profoundly shaped by the mid and late 2000s and the early 2010s. It's why they kind of missed the boat. It's kind of interesting. You have people who will listen to us have this conversation and they'll say, Marshall's a neocon. They'll say, you know, Marshall's a neocon. And I'm a person who, because I spent time in DC, I know what these terms mean. And if I were a neocon, my number one obsession right now would be transforming the Russian state. I'd be making arguments about, see, this is why America needs an agenda of democracy promotion. If there were more democracies like Ukraine, the U.S. would be safer. If we had more democracy in the Middle East, U.S. would be safer. Those were the specific neocon arguments. I instead, to your point, am making hawkish arguments about deterrence, which are separate from the ideological regime change, nation building debates from the 2000s. They can be wrong, but I think it's really key that people understand there's actually a significant departure there. And by understanding the nuance there, you'll have a better response if you disagree with me.
Yeah, that's a realist argument in the school of foreign policy and international relations.
Yeah, so let's get to the next topic I wanted to hit. So we were really getting into it around Russia's end game and off ramps. And I'm just curious where you, I won't, you know, feel need to cite David too much because you weren't on the episode, obviously, but I basically ended up here. I said, and David agreed very clearly that this operation, and this isn't just our opinion, this is just a fact, was supposed to take 3 to 4 days. This was premised on either a Zelensky surrender. This was premised on the airborne troops capturing Kyiv and other cities rather quickly, paper tigers in the West, surrender, or a regime decapitation through an assassination attempt. As of today, the reporting is that there have been up to 3 separate attempts by Russian special forces to assassinate Zelensky. Because of none of that's happened, the period is getting longer and longer and longer. And my point, which is essentially responding to people who are saying we need to find an exit ramp for Putin, is I don't know what that exit ramp would be, because with every single day, with every single shelling of a civilian building, Putin is less capable of installing a puppet regime that would have legitimacy. He is less capable of ensuring that Russia doesn't suffer severe long-term economic damage that would hamper their ability to prosecute an occupation or support a successor Ukrainian state. And then finally, it makes it harder and harder and harder for them just to basically declare victory. So what do you think about this idea of exit ramps once they lost that 3 or 4 day mandatory to their plans perspective?
Yeah. So again, just to preface that all of my opinions on this matter are informed by other people who are experts on it, who I read. And so with that said, I would say that this is a really tricky situation because it's hard to envision what the Ukrainians would consider to be a fair peace at this point. So in other words, what kind of terms of peace, we were talking about an off rank, we're also talking about some kind of a peace deal or cessation of hostilities. What would satisfy the Ukrainians who are currently having their country shelled? It's hard to imagine what that would be. Two, what would satisfy the Western alliance so that they feel that they sufficiently punished and did not reward Putin for his actions? And three, what would allow him to feel safe? Because he really has become an international pariah. To such a degree that even the Chinese have put distance between themselves and Putin and the Kremlin. And so, for someone like Putin, who even in his press conferences is at a huge distance from his military leaders and advisors, there are questions as to why that is. Some rumors are that he's not vaccinated and he's worried about getting COVID. So there are rumors that he's been poisoned in the recent past, and so he's keeping a certain distance. It's really unclear. If you're dealing with a guy who's paranoid and very worried about getting assassinated, who has used poison on lots of other people and could ascribe to his enemies his own motivations, it's hard to imagine what would make him feel safe. What kind of a peace deal would make him feel safe? And so the way that I thought about this is that I feel like there's no way he's going to stop. He's going to do everything he can to even secure a Pyrrhic victory, because so long as he dominates Ukraine in the short term, he has at least something to negotiate with. Right now, he's got nothing. He has his country is being sanctioned in unprecedented ways. I mean, we've seen sanctions used in two primary ways in our lifetimes. One has been as a slap on the wrist to say you did a bad thing. We want you to know you did a bad thing. Or two, we want to cripple your economy over a period of time so that you are unable to develop a nuclear weapons program or some kind of biological weapons program.
So that was Iran. What was this first
Iran.
One?
What's the first one? The first one is any kind of example where a country has done something like Russia in 2014 with annexing Crimea. In this case, this is different. This is not just about crippling an economy over time or making an economy, making it very difficult to invest in the things that you need to develop a weapons program. This is about actually dropping the bottom out of an economy immediately, so hard and so fast, so that it becomes difficult to prosecute a war in real time. And that is if that's not economic warfare that can be thought of similarly as actual warfare, I don't know what is, which is why I also worry about as an amateur guy, my thinking is one possible path here is that he tries to consolidate and control Ukraine, institute martial law or do whatever he has to do domestically in order to gain control, which he's already been doing. He's been cracking down on media sources and dissent as well. I saw something about forced conscription for people that are protesting the war, conscription into the Russian military. Once he's, I think, stabilized his situation, just temporarily stabilized, then I think he can consider his other options, whether those are returning to the bargaining table, whether those are further escalation. And one of my concerns has been cyber escalation in areas of like attacking the payment system. He feels morally justified to do that because we've attacked his payment system using financial sanctions, so he can do it using cyber means. Similarly, transportation. The Russian aviation industry has been absolutely crippled. Again, my opinion on this is informed by experts, but from what I understand, it isn't just international travel. Within a matter of weeks, Russians are not going to be able to travel domestically. The commercial aviation sector will be crippled because even most of their aircraft, from what I understand, are Airbus and Boeing are foreign manufactured. There is one domestic manufacturer, but they use General Electric and Rolls-Royce engines, and those companies have refused to service their aircraft. So there's only a matter of time until they cannot actually travel domestically. This is really profound. So this is a man who is just operating under siege right now, and we don't really know where he's going to end up until he's gotten to some sort of dry ground. I think that's what he's trying to do. And until he gets there, we really don't know what he's going to do or where this goes.
I want to spend a lot of time here because, as you said, you and I are interviewers. We speak to experts. We're not experts ourselves, but there are just some really profound value questions here that aren't necessarily about us knowing the exact nature of a Su-35 versus a Su-25. These are fighter ground attack jets in the Russian and Ukrainian air forces. So let's just start here. Here's the problem for Putin, and they have to factor in. So let's just focus on not his personal psychology as much, but just the factors that have to go into him making this decision. Every single day that this goes on, and this includes with an occupation, which they would have to do at this point, given just the nature of how mobilized the Ukrainian population is against this current Russian invasion, and almost certainly against a Quisling puppet regime. Every day this goes on, I think the West, military to just the common general public like you and I, are more and more convinced that the Russian army is a paper tiger. Every time you see a video on YouTube of Ukrainians discovering Russian rations that are from 2015, every time a Russian soldier breaks security and says on TikTok, hey, we've been sleeping on the ground because we don't have tents for 3 days. Every time Russian elite paratroopers, there's a great thread on this, I'll try to find a link on it. Every time Russian elite paratroopers are basically revealed to be largely paper tigers themselves, the West is going to conclude more and more and more that the threat from Putin is not going to be his armed forces. It's going to be his nuclear stockpile, which is always the concern there. But it just seems to me when it comes to his security, I have a hard time looking at the Russian military right now. And I've asked this question of experts. Mm-hmm. I asked this question of Dave. I've asked this of a variety of folks. And the conclusion is, wow, Putin reformed the military. But this is not the military of the Soviet Union, even in the 80s, during the height of defense spending, even during the debacle in Afghanistan on their part. You know, at the height of the Cold War, the assumption was U.S. forces in Western Europe, barring a nuclear response, were essentially doomed, because the second that Russia decided to go in and take Western Europe, they could do it. The assumption was they would be able to make it to the border of Spain, just in terms of the sheer power they had, the competency of the military. And it's hard to look at what's happening here right now and conclude that they have that level of power. So if Putin has to factor this in when he considers, hey, if I keep this up and I continue to suffer the losses I'm suffering, am I actually going to reduce my security? Because it will convince people more and more that I don't have, that not only do I not have a pure military, but I actually have a hobbled ersatz version of the 1980s Soviet Union. But I'm curious how you think about this dynamic.
Interesting. So you're saying that David felt that the longer he used the military, the more he exposes his own incompetence and
his
weakness.
That's my opinion. David thought, here's what David's opinion is. David's opinion was the Russian military has not performed what anyone expected it to perform. Yeah. At. The Sagar covered this on Breaking Points. There's literal rot on Russian tires. It's funny. We had a call from an audience member who's from Iowa, and he was talking about, hey, like everyone who grows up on a farm knows that you can't just leave big rubber tires on a tractor fallow for like 5 or 6 years, because, you know, rubber is like not synthetic, like rubber is an actual thing. So if you just leave it sitting somewhere without any movement for a couple years, they will literally start to rot. So what you do is you take it out during the summer and you drive it, whether or not you're actually using it for work. They aren't doing basic things like that. And that's just shocking.
Yeah. So I guess I'm not a military expert either. I've tried to follow this angle as well. It seems that there are two schools of thought on this. One is that indeed this is a military problem, that this is a reflection of a really bad army, of a really bad military. The other point of view is that this is maybe partly a reflection of some of their insufficiencies and incompetencies, but it's also a reflection of a really bad strategy. This attempt to sort of do a lightning rush, a blitz, to Kiev and installing a puppet regime, and that this ultimately has cost them in terms of logistics and organization. I mean, one classic example is there would have been highway of death were NATO operating in the skies, that giant, you know, multi-mile long train of tanks that have basically stalled because they haven't properly figured out maintenance and gas for the vehicles. I don't know. That's my view on it. I hesitate to draw too strong conclusions right now. It's so early. I use the example of Iraq. You know, in the early days of Iraq, we had Baghdad Bob coming out telling us that everything was
Baghdad Bob for the younger listeners.
Baghdad. That's the name we gave him in America because he was, from our perspective, a comedian. Though he was actually a press secretary, speaking on behalf of the Ba'athist regime, extolling the successes that the regime was having and that the Iraqi armed forces were having in expelling the great Satan of the American occupier. So I hesitate. It's still early. There's so much misinformation. For example, yesterday, once I landed, I was away in Mexico, literally left on Wednesday. I mean, so inopportune. We had a great time, but man, it was really inopportune. And we got back last night, and the moment I landed in the airport at 8 p.m., I get texts from friends saying, the Russians are shelling a nuclear state, the biggest nuclear reactor in Europe, and it's going to be 10 times worse than Chernobyl. And I was like, chillaxo. I don't believe you. I don't believe this. I'm going to wait and see. And turned out that this was misinformation. It was propaganda on the part. It wasn't that there wasn't a fire attack, but it was propaganda on the part of the Ukrainians. There's tons of propaganda on the part of the Ukrainians. I support the Ukrainians in this case. I'm not saying that But I mean that if I'm trying to be objective and understand what's really going on, I'm going to be really careful because everyone's propagating misinformation and falsehoods right now. And so I hesitate to really come down with a strong opinion on this, considering the number of assumptions required.
I love you setting this up that way, because this actually gets to something I've been thinking about, which is about how do people sort through what's happening? I've been citing you to folks when we have, because Sagar and I have had this big debate around the intelligence community. And like you said on our first episode, the key thing here is, hey guys, how could we assess that we should directionally trust the claims? Well, the fact that there are 150,000 troops on the border, if there are 150,000 troops on the border and there are medical tents and they're shipping in blood and plasma, it's reasonable to assume, but it's not much of a stretch that there is going to be an invasion, especially given Putin's writings. But so that's one factor. And that's the example of a contentious debate that obviously, and I think correctly, I could take it, you know, we can take it, I don't want to say victory lap because it's morbid, but
I took mine in my own head primarily.
Yeah.
And in private conversations, but I wouldn't call it a victory lap, but yes.
Yeah. It's just sort of like, no shit, people. That's what I'll say. A lot of folks, like, once again, I think of permanently, I want to say something about this real quick, because it's difficult because, you know, we have a lot of friends in these spaces, but just a lot of folks apologized for getting it wrong and then have gone on to basically display the same approach and style of thinking that led them to make the conclusion in the opposite direction. So it's not that they can't be right as they're going now, but the core failure for me is, once again, people are overly dogmatic. Once again, I appreciate how you keep reiterating, hey, like, I am not an expert. I am citing this person. If you are in our business, you basically should not, this is not news, what we're doing right now. Mm. This isn't really analysis. This is a, this is a quasi entertainment product where we are informed people who we are articulating to people. Podcasting at its best is, hey, like, two smart friends of yours are sitting down and they're talking about something and you're going to take that with a grain of salt. Too many people in our space forget that fact. And I think do themselves disservice. But that being said, to your point around the nuclear reactor, use the smell test, people. This is actual advice that I will actually give. Would Russia really be literally lobbing tank missiles to the point, the biggest nuclear extent? That didn't make any sense to me. So not that there wasn't fighting, not that there wasn't imagery, but I had the same reaction you had where I said, okay, this seems bad, but it doesn't quite pass the smell test for what's going on here. And obviously Zelensky is going to have an incentive. Again, I don't want to say worship, but like, I adjacently worship Zelensky in terms of his leadership and his model. And, you know, some people are tweeting, and some right-wing people who I'm very pissy about are tweeting things like, oh, like, he's the next Dr. Fauci, you know, something's going to come out and this or that. Like, I honestly don't care. What matters right now is that he stayed in Kyiv and he's providing leadership, and that's what's important. I think that's the model of leadership, which I don't think I struggle to think of a single other Western leader who could have pulled that off, and that's all I care about. But that being said, I'm still like, hey, Zelensky, we know you're trying to encourage that no-fly zone. Like, that's why you're saying this. An example of this smell test thing is this morning, and this is the other direction. We're going to get into this whole like deplatforming cancellation of Russia debate, but Michael Brendan Doherty was tweeting about how Disney Plus took down 1997's Anastasia, the animated movie. And he was like, this has gone too far, because this is part of this debate around corporations going way too aggressive, sanctioning Russian things. And I was just sort of like, yeah, that really doesn't pass my smell test. There's been removing of Russian flags. There has been a pet association removing Russian cats. There have been things which you could argue of overreach, but it just seemed to me, we've thought about this in the China context, massive multi-billion dollar Disney does not wake up one day and say, hey, we're going to remove a catalog item based on 3 days of war. I just do not believe it. I believe a small business does that. A startup can do that. A medium-sized company, Disney, no. So you click on the article he's citing, and obviously it's stated with an article, oh, this happened because on March 1st, the contract was up and they switched it to a different streaming service. That is an example of how people should approach this. Smell test. Does this act? Because once again, you can't always be an expert, but as you did with the nuclear thing, and as I did with the thing, you could think critically,
Is the CEO of Disney really going to okay removing a 1997 cartoon about pre-Soviet Russia? They would never do that this quickly.
Yeah. No. So, I mean, first of all, again, it's important enough to recognize that something I tweeted out early on in this conflict, that we're all conscripts, whether willingly or unwillingly, in an information war. Some people are fighting a kinetic war. Other people are experiencing the cyber attacks. But we're in one way in which we're all participants is that we're all sharing and participating in this narrative construction, this propaganda war, this information war. And so one area where we can all exercise a level of agency and influence and have an impact is in developing critical thinking frameworks around how we analyze information. And, you know, one metaphor that came to my mind when you were talking is if you're an athlete and you're in your peak athletic conditioning, you can get away with doing a lot of shit wrong. But a really disciplined athlete doesn't skip out on the basic things that you should always do before you begin to exercise, dynamic stretching, whatever else it is, warming up. You don't skip out on those things. And so similarly, I think the same principle has to hold when it comes to information and analysis and spreading information. Always go, you have to have a protocol. Always check yourself. Hold on. Why am I tweeting this right now? Am I tweeting it because I actually think it's important and it's true? Or am I tweeting it because I'm motivated by the need to be out there, have something to say? Because the dynamic that we've been living through in the last several years has been one of that rewards anger, moralization, and certainty. This is the paradigm. And this is the paradigm that led these people astray. And it's the paradigm that they're falling back into again. And they're going to have the same problems all over again. And this brings me to something that's really important, Marshall, because you and I were both right, so to speak. I mean, say what it is in our positions ahead of time. Again, I released an episode with Dmitry Alperovich in December titled Why Putin Will Invade Ukraine. So at the same time, I now am concerned about people getting swept up in this anti-Russian fever. And we can easily cascade in the opposite direction where we overlook censorship domestically, authoritarian measures domestically, and the empowerment of a security state in the United States in order to fight this demon, this new sort of devil in the form of Putin. Putin is in all likelihood a kind of beady-eyed, paranoid control freak, you know, in many ways a control freak the way that many of the politicians that we despise are. He just has more power, more control. He's able to operate, and he has means at his disposal that American politicians don't have. But we shouldn't turn him into this great Satan for which any means are justified, because they aren't. So that's where I'm concerned right now, that we go desperately in the opposite direction. And I want to say one more thing too, because again, I've been supportive of the Biden administration in this case. I have not been universally supportive of the Democrats or Biden in general. I want to also say though, and again, I emphasize with what I just said, I'm concerned about the Biden administration and authoritarianism. I think this crisis has also revealed some of the nasty underbelly of the right-wing movement in America. And I have been very critical of the left's portrayal of the right as these neo-Nazi white supremacists, that this is what the Trump supporters are. I don't think that's accurate. I never felt it was accurate. However, there's a contingent of people within the party and within the right-wing establishment that I think is dangerous. I think that they are they have malintentions. I hesitate to use the word traitorous, because that comes with a lot of connotations. But I think we have to watch these people as well. We have to watch both of these. The left has been, in my opinion, the left has been authoritarian. The right has not been, but the right has latent authoritarian tendencies, some of which I feel have come out during this crisis. And I'm concerned. I'm concerned about both of these wings of American politics.
Yeah, it's so interesting because the number one mistake you can make is you can overstate how prevalent and powerful various factions of both sides of ideological debates are. So once again, the polling is actually pretty clear. Republicans are actually pretty broadly supportive of the Biden status quo. This is one of the few areas of just near as close to bipartisan agreement as we could get. That said, to your point, there has been this really awful part of right-wing Twitter, which has, and this is, and once again,
Mike, and I should, let me add also, Marshall, please continue, yeah, hold your thought, don't lose it. I just want to add FinTwit and crypto Twitter also. There's a contingent of people in that area as well who actively root for the collapse of the dollar, and whose motivations don't align with a sort of unified national agenda that I think can be a righteous agenda without, again, with all the necessary caveats of getting too jingoistic and all that stuff. But go ahead.
No, thank you for saying that, because you're right. This isn't actually about debates between national conservatives and the new right. There's been a lot of people in crypto Twitter because, you know, I work at a tech company. So I see these people who, I mean, Tucker Max did this, and Tucker Max is a, you know, has been from the 2000s who wrote like raunchy, like sex stories, but he got a lot of engagement here because he was adapting a style of rhetoric, which has become increasingly popular, which is he was tweeting, I don't know what to think. The media lies. So I'm just going to start from there. And what I particularly hate about this style of rhetoric is it pretends it's neutral when it's obviously pro-Russian. If you, and this is the thing, which is, it's actually incredibly pro. And this is what people have to be very certain about. So I want to be very precise, because as you said, we need to be very precise with our language. I am not saying that certain people on right-wing crypto Twitter support Vladimir Putin. However, you can make arguments or advance frames that end up advancing a state of affairs that Putin wants and empowers Putin. So saying, I don't know what to think. I can't know what to think. You know, Tucker Max went to UChicago Law School. This is not a dumb person. He's very smart. He's a great writer, despite the topic area. You could separate those two things. The idea that he cannot do what you and I just did and say, smell test, this is just absolutely ridiculous. What people are doing is they are advancing frames, because once again, this isn't the time to do it. But the post-op I'm fascinated by is the post-op of how, if the Iraq war demonstrated that the New York Times, Judith Miller, et cetera, were far too credulous towards the intelligence community, I think this crisis has revealed that independent media has a really negative set of assumptions driven by the subscription economy and driven by Twitter engagement to basically say, I don't know what's what, but here's what I do know. The media is your enemy. The establishment is your enemy. Everyone is your enemy. Now, once again, we're not referring to any experts. So you know what? I don't agree with John Mearsheimer. I'm not citing John Mearsheimer. I don't agree with Richard Hanania. I think he's very toxic on Twitter. But guess what? Like, he's a serious PhD. Mm-hmm. He studies, like, he actually, you know, we have had him on the podcast before. But that's not who I'm talking about. I am talking about people who ostensibly claim they are neutral when they advance frames that are good. When Putin is literally launching missiles into civilian homes in Kyiv, he wants people to look at that missile strike and say to themselves, I'm not sure if that's real. I think that's CNN manipulating me into money and war for profits. And the last thing I'll add here before I throw this to you is the number one thing, because I want people to have tools, because I think what people appreciated about our last conversation is they came away with tools and frameworks for how we think about these things. So I think they could be useful. Be skeptical of people with very little foreign policy experience who run all, and once again, this isn't a credentialist thing. So I'm talking about people who up until last week did not think about foreign affairs, did not write about foreign affairs, did not do all these things. Like, once again, you and I have been, we're not like experts, quote unquote, but we've been doing this for a long, long, long time. People who make up for their lack of knowledge by substituting in US domestic political and culture war dynamics. So someone who says, look, I didn't know what the Donbass was until last week. I didn't think about this. I was writing about Black Lives Matter overreach last summer, or I was writing about COVID overreach and Dr. Fauci last summer. But now I'm engaged on this topic. I'm going to say things like, well, and I'm sure you see these people who tweet like, well, some people who are super pro Dr. Fauci are now super pro Ukraine. We should be skeptical of that. I see a lot of big right-wing accounts tweeting stuff like this. The second someone basically says that, I'm going to discount them as a person on this topic, because once again, all they are actually doing is for money and engagement, easily substituting copy and paste US domestic policy dynamics that, look, I think can be useful. I think it's good to critique the center left. I think the Substack Newserati is actually very good at that. Like good coverage of all the crazy stuff the San Francisco School Board was doing, but do not take that analysis and apply it to what's happening in Ukraine right now when civilians are dying.
Totally, man. Well, a few thoughts. So one, some heuristics I always look out for. If someone says I predicted this, I immediately stop listening to what they have to say. And that is a way of also kind of speaking to the larger point about humility. You know, I look for people that are humble. Because even Zelensky was unbelieving of an invasion days before it actually happened. Like it was only, I think, several days before that he finally got the message, you know? So like the future is a fog. Mm-hmm. It's full of uncertainty. And we ascribe to it levels of uncertainty that simply are not warranted. And we look at the past as a guidepost for the future, when oftentimes the future surprises us in ways that are deeply consequential. The fattest tails are the ones that we don't see. Mm-hmm. And those are the ones that have the most impact. So I want to say that too. Yes, I totally agree. When I see people trying to fit square pegs into round holes, that also is a giant red flag for me. Classic examples in crypto, people saying, this shows Bitcoin's important. What's going on in Ukraine, whether you want to take it from the standpoint of the Russians who are now, let's say, they're seeing a collapse in the ruble, or something about, you know, Ukrainians trying to flee Ukraine. This is a case for crypto. Again, I hate seeing stuff like that. It's like, this is not about money. This is not about your investment portfolio. That's a crass thing to bring up. And this is, I am taking a moral stance here. I find it morally repugnant. And there's a lot of that going on because we have financialized the narrative space. Mm-hmm. Right? Like people have been able to monetize narratives today in ways that they didn't. And in crypto actually in some ways facilitates that in many ways, because ultimately the vast majority of value that exists in crypto is not actually in the utility of the underlying token or cryptocurrency. It is in the Ponzi dynamics lubricated by the narrative storytelling in each vertical of these tokens and cryptos. So in this space, people's reputations as those who are in the know and being able to speak with certainty has been consistently rewarded. It brings me back to the point. There's not going to be, and I do not favor having some kind of government truth ministry deciding what is and what is not misinformation. Okay. And that's another thing what we should probably talk about, which is where, because I'm very concerned about that, man, you know, and that there is a selfish component here, because I am a podcast producer, creator, host, and I create content, and I don't want to see myself get censored. I could easily see myself getting censored at some point because I don't make the rules in such a scenario of what is and what is not disinformation. So I think that's a big area of concern for me and how that evolves going forward.
Yeah. So I want to raise two broad things before we have to cut at the hour. Let's start here. We talked about this during your first episode. You worked at RT, mm-hmm. Russia Today, and Russia Today, as of yesterday, the third, shut down in the US. So I would just love to hear, I'm actually deeply curious about your perspective on this issue.
Yeah. I saw Margarita, my old boss. Well, she was the head of RT. I worked directly for the guy that worked for her, tweeted out that the shutting down of RT was a speech issue, which is total bullshit. You know, RT is a national propaganda network that I feel perfectly fine having the US government shut down. And let me explain.
Quick fact check. Ooh, fact check. It wasn't that the US government shut it down. It was that cable providers dropped it. Because this is very key to the, sure, to the discussion.
Okay, so it's still available on the internet, which is where it actually is most potent. So when I say I'm totally okay with it being shut down, I want to be very clear about what I mean here and under what conditions I would be okay with that. Mm-hmm. The only condition in which I would be okay with that is if the U.S. puts out very clear, whatever department is in charge of this, whether it's the FCC or whatnot, puts out very clear guidelines about like why it was shut down. Because if we're talking about like a foreign propaganda network that you can cite specific examples of, and I'm sure you can find so many of them with RT, then we have clear ideas of what we're talking about. But don't use that to go shut down Ben Shapiro, who I can't stand listening to, but I don't want you to shut down Ben Shapiro. I don't want you to shut down Tucker Carlson either. And I don't want you to shut down Rachel Maddow, even though I think she's leaving to do a movie or something, or any of these people. I don't want them to be shut down, as much as I know the world would be a better place without the cacophony of these voices. That's my view, to be clear. But that doesn't want, I don't mean I want you to shut them down. So I think just RT is a unique case because this is a national security threat. Like you're dealing with this is the information arm of a multi-prong military strategy. And information war has been one of the really successful areas in which the Russian government and the Kremlin have operated. So, you know, RT has always been a propaganda arm, fine. So has CNN. They just gotten worse. When I worked there, they were, and I was used indirectly, I guess, as a way of pushing their propaganda because I was discontent and unhappy with American financial policy, central banking, Fed policy, and that discontent worked in the Kremlin's advantage. But I still think that at the time that I worked there, that was a fair trade-off because the American networks were enabling the looting that happened in the U.S. So having a foreign network that was willing to call it out, I think actually served our interests. After 2012 and the bombing in Syria and the Russian intervention there, I think that RT took a turn for the worst. And then obviously the situation with Ukraine, ever since then, RT has just been just doubled down and doubled down and doubled down. And the people that they feature tend to just be conspiracy theorists and folks like that. So I have no problem putting guardrails around RT. They're doing the same thing, forget American media outlets. They're literally censoring the crap out of their domestic independent media. So
no, this is, now what I love about what you just did there is you gave a framework, which, like I said, it was technically the cable companies which dropped it, aka cutting the cable bills that paid for it. But the framework you applied actually applies to both, which is to the government at the FC, you know, at the FCC, or if you're a cable company executive, which is, this is not a countryman of yours. This is not a news station from a democratic country. This is a literal state-owned network during a universally condemned foreign policy crisis/invasion that is at home shutting down its own independent media and then using this to put forward content. That is a framework which, like you said, differentiates this from CNN, differentiates it from MSNBC, differentiates this from Al Jazeera, differentiates this from the Turkish news station. The claim here is not foreigners can't put news in, not any of these other things. And once again, a classic tactic that you will get is whataboutism. And from, you know, I'm sure foreign people will listen to this show. And here's what I would basically say. What I would say to you is, if the U.S. government shut down, to be clear, this is the principal position. If the U.S. government, while invading Iraq, 2003, shut down all critical media, like every, not just like shut down MSNBC, but actually unironically shut down every single competing to the government's narrative media thing in the entire country. If, once again, they had laws like, if you protest against this war, you will go to have to serve in the front lines as a conscript. You know what? If you're Australia, if you're France, if you're Great Britain, you are totally justified for those same reasons. to ban CNN. I would entirely think that is entirely justifiable. Sorry, to ban Fox News if the Bush administration is using it that way. This is a consistent set of principles mm-hmm. that should apply across nations. And once again, one that we can judge. Despite everything, the Bush administration did not shut down Air America. The Bush administration actually let RT come about. Al Jazeera launched programming. Al Gore had Current TV. Mm-hmm. There's Democracy News. There's YouTube. The U.S., despite the debates around misinformation, which weren't even happening back then, is a rich media ecosystem, which is what differentiates it from Russia during a time of war. So for the last section, something I'd like to talk about is I would love to get your thoughts, because actually, I don't know what you're going to say about this, which is a compliment to you about not being predictable. I would like you to give your perspective in these last 8 minutes on private companies, banks, et cetera, pulling out of Russia. I'm really reluctant to use the word cancel, because I think honestly, when you use cancel in this category, you are basically playing into a frame that helps people who are actually in favor of cancel culture. Because you think, you know, the generic response, like, mm-hmm. you mean you're saying cancel culture, right winger? You really just mean accountability. Because sometimes it's actually a very good point, which is like, hey, Putin, like, if you launch like a war of choice and kill thousands of civilians, yeah, dude, like you're going to suffer consequences. That's not mm-hmm. canceling you. Like you did this actively. So I'm not going to say, I don't like the word cancel. I don't even like the word deplatform because it's a little more accurate, but it also has a moral weight to it. But there are complicated dynamics here in terms of like, are companies going to go too far? Who polices company actions? Because a lot of this is private. A lot of this is internationalized. How are you thinking about this space?
Great question. First of all, I do want to say I'm going to be doing at least one, but probably many more than one episode on the sanctions regime. I haven't had a chance to do that yet. I have one scheduled for either Monday or Tuesday. And so I'm going to begin to prepare for that tomorrow, which means I'm going to begin to think about this more, including the question of, you know, do I support this? How much do I support it? I would be surprised if I come away not supporting it, or rather not fully supporting it. I think I would fully support it because I think also you have to ask yourself a question, which is like, first of all, I have no moral qualms about shutting down the bank accounts of anyone who was involved or supporting the invasion of Ukraine from a moral standpoint. The question is, to what degree should there be collateral damage from the actions of the Russian state? Because clearly there are millions of Russians who don't support this, whose lives are being upended as a result. So that's the one area where I have to sort of just think it through. Mm-hmm. But I, in general, support the use of sanctions in this context, when it comes to international warfare, because I think we're at war. I think the United States has been at war with Russia. And perhaps it hasn't, a lot of people haven't understood this, and it's been at war with China as well, even longer, I think. And so it's just late to joining the fight. And I think this is just one area. Financial warfare is one area of this, you know, economic and financial warfare, narrative warfare, cyber warfare, kinetic warfare. These are all avenues. We're familiar with kinetic. We've become more familiar with cyber. It's time for us to become more familiar with economic and financial warfare as well. And that's where we're at. And so I think I'll come down on the side of supporting it.
And you mentioned before we started recording that you'd started listening to my first daily coverage episode of Nate Sibley. And Nate, I did not think about this issue this way until Nate made this argument. Anyone who has not listened, I really recommend you do. Nate pointed out that a lot of the rhetoric around the sanctions policy is actually entirely incorrect. So a lot of people say things like, why do we expect to sanction them until they overthrow the government? That basically never happens. That's actually not the argument for these sanctions. The argument for these sanctions is, and this is to your point, this is why this is better thought of as economic warfare than like punishment or regime change. The purpose of the sanctions policy, the purpose of wrecking the banking system, the purpose of keeping their stock market closed, the purpose of shutting off their economy is to actually reduce Russia's ability as a great power to prosecute a war in Ukraine. the purpose of limiting, and they must point out, this war is costing Russia billions of dollars a week. Billions of dollars that they are increasingly unable to prosecute. They are, as you said, unable to get parts. They're unable to pay people the same way. It's actually limiting Russia's economic capacity, because he made this, another, just really can't keep citing this. He pointed out that, you know, people like to say, oh, Russia is an economy the size of Italy, therefore it's not that big of a deal. He said, well, yeah, that's true. However, it's an economy the size of Italy that basically only does two things, or three things in this case. Energy, finance, and warfare, the military right now. So the purpose of targeting the economy here is not to convince the Russians to overthrow the government. I don't think anyone is making this decision that way. The purpose is, if the Russian economy is severely hampered, if there is actually severe cost, that is playing into Putin's mind right now. At this rate, where the Russian economy is crashing, they are not going to prosecute a multi-year occupation of the country. And that is what the purpose of the strategy is. I do not think we are making any decision thinking, if we do X, Putin leaves office in the next 6 weeks. If we do X, a colonel shoots him in the back of the head. That is not the decision here. The decision is, his economy is a tool to prosecute this war of aggression. How do we take this tool away from him as aggressively as possible? And I think that better frames how this isn't about punishing everyday Russians. This is about the fact that they are collateral damage, to your point, to a strategy designed to limit the ability of the state. We've got 2 minutes left. I have a breaking points recording here, but I'd love for you just to close up with any broad thoughts you have, any episodes people should check out, anything like that.
Yeah, I think we kind of covered most of my strong opinions on things right now. I'm going to be doing a lot of episodes. Like I said, I did an episode with Dmitry Alperovich. Dmitry's coming back on. He's the founder of CrowdStrike. He's coming back on today to kind of do a recap on everything. I've done a lot of episodes on this man, Thomas Ridd, going back, Thomas Ridd on disinformation. David Kilcullen on liminal warfare and conceptual envelopment, Peter Zeihan, John Mearsheimer, who a lot of people talked about. He's come on the podcast. We talked about Ukraine then, Stephen Walt. So lots of people, the Secretary of Defense, Ash Carter. I recommend that people go through the episode library of Hidden Forces to see kind of what we've done. They can find that at hiddenforces.io.
Hiddenforces.io, and they can also support you on Supercast if they want to help you produce and put out this like really great show and help support conversations like these. So, Dmitry, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Marshall.
It's been really great.
Thank you.